Welcome, members and guests, to the December 4th program of the City Club of Eugene. Science, policy, and the passion and passion reflect challenges facing bees. Thank you for joining us. I'm James Baldock, City Club President. Our sponsors today are Oregon Country Fair, July 8th, 9th, 10th, 2016, Eugene Legal, Small Firm, Big Results, and Pack Info, Internet Solutions. Special thanks go to KPFF Consulting Engineers for supplying our office space, and to KLCC Radio for airing these programs at 6:30 on Monday nights and for archiving the podcasts on their site. We'd also like to thank Community Television of Lane County for televising recent City Club programs Monday through Friday at noon, Saturday at 10:30 a.m., and Sunday at 9 p.m. A quick reminder that we host nearly 50 original nonpartisan issue programs every year, and today is our 12th program in our 2015-2016 programming year. If you believe with us that civic engagement is the lifeblood of democracy, please join us. We welcome donors, sponsors, members, volunteers, and students, anyone who has a stake in community life. Today's program, Science, Policy, and Passion Reflect Challenges Facing Bees, is coordinated by Lisa Arkin. Our guest speakers today are Ramesh Sajili, Amy Code, and Jen Hornaday. Today's speakers will discuss the role of honeybees and native bees in everything from Oregon's agricultural sector to children's environmental education at school. The presentation will then hone in on risks that pollinators face and suggest actions that anyone can take to better protect pollinators from pesticides. I'll introduce the speakers' bios now. Dr. Ramesh Sajili is a honey and bee research and extension faculty in the Department of Horticulture at Oregon State University. His primary research focus at OSU is honeybee health, nutrition, and pollination. He initiated the creation of Oregon Master's Beekeeper Program in 2010. Amy Code is the Pesticide Program Director at the Searcy Society for Invertebrate Conservation. She has more than 17 years of experience working to protect people and the environment from pesticides. Amy received her Master's of Science in Environmental Health with a minor in Toxicology from Oregon State University. Jen Hornaday and her husband Doug started beekeeping in 2010 and created Healthy Bees Equals Healthy Gardens, a local neighborhood organization dedicated to the preservation of honeybees. The organization's goal is to help educate the community about how we can live together in a healthy and safe environment that is free from harmful chemicals. They manage over 25 honeybee hives in the Eugene area. Let's give a round of applause to the speakers, and thanks some beavers for coming into town.
Good afternoon, and thanks, James, for the introduction, and City Club of Eugene. I'm very thankful that you organized this event and my panel members here as well. I'm excited to be here. So, as James introduced, I'm a honeybee research and extension faculty at Oregon State University. So my focus areas of research are honeybee health, pollination, and nutrition. But I'm not going to talk about research today, but just will emphasize the importance of pollinators, the challenges that bees are facing today, what you can do as citizens to promote bee health, and what kind of work is being done at this point to promote bee health across the nation as well as in Oregon. So bees are vital for our food production, as we all understand, and they're very important for our functional ecosystem as well. But unfortunately, they have been taken for granted for a long time, as many of you will agree. I'll give you a good example. Many of you might have seen a picture of some Chinese pear growers standing on pear trees and pollinating pear with hand, using a stick with some feathers at the end and touching the pollen in a cup. So how efficient is that pollination? Is that affordable or is it practical? So I'll leave that up to you to think about it. So that's just to tell you how important bees are, and probably sometimes we take them as granted. So I'll very quickly try to emphasize the importance of pollinators, like especially bees in general. So bee pollination is about $20 billion worth in the United States and about $500 million in the state of Oregon. So it's a huge, huge number. And there are about 90 different crops that are being pollinated by bees. And that includes your fruits, vegetables, and nuts, and most of the stuff that you're eating today as well. There is a statistics which says 1/3 of our diet literally comes from bee pollination. So they're very important. So there are about 2.6 million honeybee colonies. Today I'm more talking about honeybees because I'm a honeybee specialist. But again, I am not being biased towards honeybees here. I really respect the other bees that there are around as well. So there are about 90 different crops, as I said, includes your fruits, vegetables, and nuts. And then we have about 2.6 million colonies here in the United States. These are commercial honeybee colonies that pollinate several crops that you are aware of. And almond in California, when you go to California, you'll see 870,000 of acres in bloom soon in February. And they take about 1.6 million hives just for pollinating almonds. So that can tell you the gravity of the bees itself is how important they are. And there is actually, as a bee researcher, again, as I said, my presentation will be more focused on honeybees, but then everything I speak also relates to other native bees that are around as well. And I'm sure most of you have heard of significant honeybee colony declines for the past, at least I would say, 8 years. And CCD, or colony collapse disorder, probably you are aware of the term as well. I know it's an unfortunate event that we have been recording for the last 8 or 9 years. But again, I would think it's a blessing in disguise as well, because it has created a lot of emphasis on bees. Bees are in limelight. People understand the importance of bees. So that much awareness was not there probably 10 years ago. So I still say CCD is a blessing in disguise, even though it's an unfortunate event. Today, bees are facing multiple challenges. The colony declines we are witnessing are multifactorial, and they are very complex as well to explain. So there are parasites and diseases, pesticides, poor nutrition, migration of colonies for pollination. There is lack of genetic diversity in our honeybees as well. And these are some factors. There are several others, but these are some main factors, I would say. They're playing a significant role in colony declines. So I'll go over each of those factors now. So parasites and diseases, like we and any other organism has their pests and disease problems. So honeybees have several of those parasites and diseases. And varroa mite, it's an ectoparasite on honeybee, is a huge, huge one. It got introduced into the United States around 1987, and since then it has played havoc on the beekeeping industry. So it has totally changed the face of beekeeping here in the United States. So it's an ectoparasite, sucks the blood of the bee, both the larval stages and the adults, and transmits at least 7 different viruses as well. So that's a huge, huge threat, and still we are dealing with that problem at this point. Then we hear a lot about pesticides, and pesticides, of course, are a problem that we need to address as well. But pesticides have been a problem for a long time, but we have gotten this renewed interest in pesticides only for the past few years, which is a good thing because there are several different modes of actions that have come in the last 10, 15 years, which are systemic as well as they can persist in the plants for a long time. So we need to look at those as well. But pesticides are usually, most of them are lipophilic. That means they can get into the wax, they can absorb into the wax and can stay there for a long, long time. So some of the wax comb we test for our research has pesticides that were never used for 10 years as well. So we need to understand most of those additive and synergistic effects of these chemicals that bees bring into the comb as well, because comb is the place where they live and it's very important for them. Then beekeepers also use some miticides, the varroa mite that I explained before. That's an ectoparasite which can't be ignored. Otherwise, 80% chance is there that their hives will succumb to this mite. So they do use some chemicals in the hives as well to control mites. And we still don't really understand how that's playing into this, but we at least believe that they're also a stress on the bees. Then malnutrition, which is again a big problem. Bees need a diverse diet like we all need, and they need a balanced diet as well, which unfortunately is not available or not accessible for bees at this point because of loss of bee habitat due to land use intensification that we see, a lot of monocropping, a lot of hybrid crops that are being grown, which are not that good for bees as well because they don't produce much nectar and pollen. So these are some major ones that I wanted to go over. So in the wake of concern regarding significant honeybee colony losses, there have been increased efforts from private agencies, public agencies. There are some nonprofit entities, even you might have heard of Xerces Society in Portland, which AMEA belongs to. They are doing a lot of work on these fronts to improve the habitat of bees as well. So I'll just go over 2 important things because of lack of time. So one is the presidential memorandum. Some of you might have heard, so the president signed a memorandum on bees in 2014 June. And actually, this was for creating a federal strategy to promote the health of honeybees and other pollinators. So I'll read something from that. So it had two important directives: establishment of a pollinator health task force, and then increasing and improving pollinator habitat. So there were 14 different agencies involved, federal agencies. And so finally, there was a strategy that was designed, and it came out recently, a few months ago, which addresses most of these issues on how to reduce honeybee colony losses, increase populations of monarch butterflies as well, and then increase this pollinator habitat for bees. So coming to Oregon, me and Amaya also served on that 2014 Governor's Task Force. We came up with several recommendations that we think are really useful, and some of them have already passed as bills in the last legislature. And there are some tips I really want to give you, last 2 seconds to take. So plant bee-friendly plants, if possible, in your backyards. Provide a lot of habitat for bees. Please sustain your passion for bees as you have been doing, and I know that's why you are here today. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Armesh, for the overview. I'm going to take a second and step away from our managed European honeybees and talk about some of the native bees that are so amazing that we have here in Oregon and around the country. And then I'm going to hone in on one of the drivers in the risk to pollinators, specifically focusing in on some of the risks that pesticides pose. And then we get to have Jen close up and with the uplifting part of what we can all do. So I'm always amazed when I start thinking about how many bees there are. We actually have over 800 species of bees right here in Oregon. There are thousands of species of bees in the United States. Some of them are only a couple millimeters in size. They're metallic green. They're blue. They're nothing like the honeybee that we imagine. They're also often solitary. The vast majority of them are a single female that provisions her nest, which is really different than this superorganism that Ramesh is talking about when we talk about a colony of bees that could be as many as 50,000 bees when it's really healthy. So the risks to these native bees is going to differ because they are so very different than our honeybees. Other than the solitary bees, we also have bumblebees. So I work at an organization that protects invertebrates, and when to the invertebrate conservation, a bumblebee is like our panda. It is the soft, fuzzy, cute, iconic creature that we hold forth, much more so than maybe an aquatic mussel or some of the other invertebrates we work on. So here in the United States, we have 45 species of bumblebees. Unfortunately, the most recent status review is showing that more than a quarter of those bumblebees are at risk of extinction. Here in Oregon, we have 7 species of bumblebees that are at risk of extinction. And many of the issues that Ramesh brought up are exactly what's driving that. They have a lack of foraging habitat as well as nesting habitat. They're being exposed to different pesticides, which is causing harm to them. They also, a number of diseases, they also are affected by diseases, sometimes coming from managed bees, other times out in the wild on their own. And when I think about our bumblebees, it's really what raised awareness here in Oregon of the risks to our bees, because it was the use of neonicotinoids, insecticides, that killed thousands of bumblebees up in Wilsonville that kind of really made us all aware of what kind of problems we were facing. So I'm going to turn to some of those pesticides. And when I use that term, by the way, pesticide is an umbrella term when you look at it in the regulatory sense. So a pesticide includes an herbicide, insecticides, and fungicides. Clearly, of the pesticides, insecticides are the most acutely and harmful to bees. Although studies are showing, don't just assume it's insecticides. We're seeing research into fungicides and other pesticides that are also causing grave concerns for our bees. So it really is an overall approach we need to take, not just removing one chemical from the system. The way we regulate pesticides here in the United States is actually a cost-benefit analysis. So the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency evaluates the perceived benefit that pesticide has and compares that to the potential harm that pesticide might cause to human health and the environment. So within that system, we are expecting there to be a risk from pesticide use, and we accept that as long as it's not, as the statute says, unreasonable. So recognizing that we have a statute that is going to allow some harm, you know, Ramesh brought in the fact that there's some new chemistries now. About 20 years ago, when neonicotinoids came on the market, we had a whole new set of concerns that arose that our current regulatory system really is unable to respond to. Yes, many pesticides, many insecticides are toxic to bees, but the neonicotinoids and other systemics are not just toxic to bees, they're also extremely long-lived and systemic. So we're seeing them move up through a plant. They're not just being exposed for maybe hours to days. They could be receiving exposure for days, weeks, months, and they could be building up through the years. So our current system doesn't really know how to respond to these chronic low-dose exposures, and we haven't yet found ways to address that through a regulatory system. The other really big concern that neonicotinoids have put out on that market, why we want to think about that as an area to make change to protect our pollinators, is because they are so broadly used. So neonicotinoids, when they came on the market, were alternatives to some of the other highly toxic insecticides out there. So we've traded one chemical for another. And in and of itself, that is a problem by itself. But the other thing about these neonicotinoids is that we've actually developed new trends in how we use insecticides. So we are now using these neonicotinoids in a prophylactic manner, in ways that we weren't using these pesticides before. So we're seeing an extreme increase in their use. If you look at the maps from the U.S. Geological Survey, it is shocking to see how prevalent their use is. And looking just at the prophylactic use, they have this use where we're using them before a pest is even present. Seed treatment is one of the examples of that. And a new study that just came out from Penn State showed that just looking at crops planted with coated seeds, we have acreage about the size of California, where that's, and that's only looking at some of the main crops. So that's probably an underestimation. Then you look at some of the other studies showing what effect do these chemicals have when seeds are coated, what effects do they have on pollinators. We're seeing fewer bees in the fields where the seeds have, where the fields have been planted with coated seed, and we're seeing our solitary bees aren't nesting in those fields. If we think about what does that mean, the size of California where we can't have our native bees be able to nest, and yes, they do nest in fields that aren't planted with coated seeds. So and the other big piece of these coated seeds is we're really questioning whether they're even effective at managing the pests that are there. So yes, there's a number, you know, there was a presidential memorandum that Ramesh brought up. We are taking steps trying to figure out how do we address these issues. But the reality is the federal government moves at a glacial pace. So do our state governments. We, you know, we work with a number of states to be taking voluntary measures, and steps are happening, but it is slow, which is why I love that we're closing with Jen's work, because really at the local level, we can make a huge difference. I don't know if you guys know this, but Eugene was actually the first city to ban neonicotinoids on city property. And so the woman who organized this, Lisa Arkin, actually was part of that effort. Since then, we have over 20 communities across the country have done the same. And the other thing is you can really make a difference at home. So one thing about our solitary bees is they usually move a couple hundred yards. So your backyard can be habitat for so many of these bee species. And you don't. As Jen's going to bring up and talk a little bit more about some of the native plants, how to create this habitat, you can also look on our website. There's a lot of information about how to create that habitat. Very quickly, I put out on the tables magazines in case people wanted to pick them up that have a lot more detail about the issues of neonicotinoids that go into some of the concerns for water quality and other pieces. So if that's something of interest.
Hi, y'all. I'm Jen Hornaday. Let me adjust this so it's up my height here. Let's see. Is that good? Okay, cool. So, yes, I've been a beekeeper for 5 years now. I did care for 25 beehives this summer, me, myself, and I, and my husband, Doug, is a wonderful arborist, so when you need those those hives caught way high in the air up in those trees, he's the one to go get that. Also, if you find yellow jacket traps in your ground, those yellow jackets live 300 yards away from where they're eating my bees. And so they could be in your compost, all warm and cozy. They're still going in and out of the hives. I saw many of them yesterday, and it's so disconcerting because my hive sticks are only open 1 inch for those bees to go out and go potty when it's warmer weather and go out and try to find something. And so please, you know, do your part. If you do see them, you can use a shop vac to suck them up, or call my husband or someone that can, you know, do that for you. So there's a lot of things that we can talk about. I've only got 8 minutes. I'm going to try to talk fast like I am to get it all in. We have created with our Honeybee Friend Pledge 5 pesticide-free neighborhoods, and I still have people coming up to me all the time saying, like, hey, you should bring a hive to my house. And I'm like, that would be really nice of me because it costs so much money, and I am so overwhelmed with just 25 hives and 3 other really big jobs in town that I do, and one is bee education at the Village School, massage therapist, and working for the City of Eugene outdoor programs. So trying to find time to do it all, I really need your all help to be able to make this all a reality to help our bees. Some of the things that we can do is to first start talking to our neighbors and our friends and our family and communicate together, like, how are we going to make a difference? What can we put in our yards to be able to have food for these bees 365 days a year, if at all possible? My friend Bruce Newhouse has this great flower chart on his website. It's, www.oregonflora.org/checklist. It's a big one. Anyway, go to Salix Associates, www.salixassociates.com/resources. That's an easier one, and you can go through Bruce Newhouse, and find those native plant charts. But in reality, the native plants that are flowering, you know, it's basically around March to September. In my yard in January this year, because it was an awkward year, I had a winter camellia. It's my favorite bush, and it's theirs. It starts in January, right in the window of my dining room window, because it's a little warm there. But I kid you not, that thing bloomed for 3.5 months, and I was like, come on over to the pear, y'all, you know, come on over to the plum and all the other things that are flowering right now to get them to pollinate the other fruit orchards that I want them to pollinate. But if they find a food source, they're not going to waste any energy going to somewhere else. Like, that one bee, when it leaves the hive, when it's 50 degrees, it's going to go from 50 to 150 flowers every time it's, you know, collecting nectar and pollen. If it's going to a sunflower or lavender, it may just hang out right there, or in thyme and oregano and other herbs, because there's tons of little tiny flowers, and that's awesome. But on their way back home, they're just going to eat enough honey just to be able to go to that plant and go back home and drop it off. They don't go to, like, a blue flower, a yellow flower, and a purple flower, and a white flower all on the same journey. They just kind of stay on that one plant, because our bees are so smart. They know what's going on. They're, you know, not trying to hurt us. They're just going to collect nectar and pollen for their hive, and they are pollinating for us. So they've been working so hard every single day, up to 10 times a day, that one single bee that's going out. And of course, there's hundreds and thousands that are out there doing this every day. So please, please think of that and treat them respect whenever you are using products in your yard, or when you're harvesting things. Take some lavender for yourself, but please leave them. Things like the vegetables that are flowering later in their cycle, like Mizuna lettuce and kale and broccoli, beautiful, tons of little yellow flowers. Take that main head of broccoli, but then on the side shoots, I take some and I leave some. The bees are getting tons of food for their home, and then after that yellow flower, what comes is a wonderful seed that's going to drop to the ground, and you're going to have some non-GMO, you know, plants already starting right back up. Total bonus for me and for y'all once you learn to do that kind of stuff. Communicate with each other. Other things you can put in the ground. Aster's a really great thing to put in springtime. It'll, over the years, it'll come up to be this huge big bush, like a big tomato plant. It's amazing how much space those can take up, but also think about how many millions of flowers that are on that and little buds, and how much food one of those asters can be able to feed. Bee balm, borage, let's see, clovers. We've got our crimson clover. It's a wonderful cover crop. But then there's the ground clover. And then dandelions. When I'm teaching the kids, I go A, B, C, D. What are these things that we can put in the ground that's easy for them to remember that can really help feed the bees year-round? The clover and the dandelions, I feel, is one of the major things that this time of year, when we've had those cold freezes, that it really is going to be helpful for them. Because if, as long as they are not coming into contact with a weed and feed Roundup or some kind of pesticide pollen, then they can, you know, bring that healthy pollen home. If they do come into contact, y'all know it's bad. They could die right there. They may get dazed, confused, disoriented, not find their way back home. If they do, they're taking that pesticide pollen, transplanting it back into our healthy gardens. If they do make it home, they're bringing pesticide pollen to feed their babies. And that really is a bummer. That's coming from us. Maybe not us, but maybe our neighbors that we really don't want to talk to. So I hope that you're all gaining this confidence now to be able to start that word, to spread that knowledge out, that education is one of the biggest things. People say, I had no idea that went systemic up into my fruit and it's going to be bad for 7 years. What should I do? My husband says, sorry, you may want to cut that tree down and start over, you know, because that is putting that out. And it really is a bummer that this stuff is out there. Please take responsibility for your actions. When you take a plant from the store, make sure that it is a good plant. You know, it may be a good plant, it may be a lavender, but take that tag out. Has it been pre-treated by something at the store before they, you know, sold it to you or from the manufacturers that made it? So there are some good stuff, but there is still bad stuff out there, even if you're taking my knowledge and taking these great plants that may be helpful for you. So the other things that I wanted to share is things like digging those weeds up. If you can't do it, hire those healthy, earth-friendly landscapers that do choose to dig and not spray. And work together as a neighbor to say, hey, this old partner down over here, this neighbor here, they can't do it anymore. Let's work together as a neighborhood to help them out. After you dig those weeds, put cardboard down. This is a great time to get tons of leaves from the city to be able to put those down. Squelch it out so that sunlight doesn't come up and allow it to resprout. And then you can put newspapers down, recycle too, instead of or with the cardboard. And then wood chips. Wood chips are good for everything. Put them around all your trees just for nutrition and squelch down from the sunlight for the weeds. So shallow water sources, that's huge. Just a pie tin with little rocks in it. The bees can perch on it. You can put them in your flower gardens or in your vegetable gardens when your natural sprinkler comes on, it fills it up when the rain comes, that's great. And then yellow jackets, they're nasty, I said it earlier. Those rescue traps, you can get them in the early springtime, and I usually put them up at shoulder height, and there's a queen pheromone that usually lasts about 8 weeks. Maybe it works 5 weeks only, but, you know, really sniff it out, see if you can still smell it, and put it up your shoulder height. Later on in the springtime, you want to move it down to, like, chest to hip height. By early summer, and then by midsummer, you want to start putting protein in there, meat. I use salmon. I rebait it every 3 to 5 days. By then, I'm moving it down to knee height. And then, you know, you really rebait it, move it down. Move it into areas where you're seeing it. Get those yellow jackets out there. When they've got yellow jackets in there, leave them, because once those stinkers are up inside there, they're just going to eat their dead sisters that are in there, and that's just pretty gross. But that's what they do. They crave the protein, and they go in and out of my hive. If they kill the queen, game over. If they don't, they're eating the honey, which they're doing now today, and they're killing the bees because they just need that protein. So looks like I got 15 seconds left. Let's see. If you've ever got any more time, you can support the city parks. I had an awful thing happen where they sprayed some herbicides in the park this spring, and it was just totally awful for me because I've been caring for the park, and they just have too many people, you know, not enough people working and doing too much work. So one of the things that you can do is to be able to volunteer to do the weeds. I've got a park next to my house that we're having a park party December 19th from 10 until 1. It's a Saturday. And to be able to come dig some of the knapweed that they said they had to spray, and then put wood chips around the trees and find ways to be able to do that. It should be written in the weekly too. So thanks so much for your time, and let's try to do our part. I guess we'll have some time for questions later. Thanks.
Okay, thank you. Today's topic is Science, Policy, and Passion Reflect Challenges Facing Bees. Our speakers are Ramesh Sajili, Amy Code, and Jen Hornaday. We'll break now for a few minutes and then return with members' questions.
You're listening to KLCC NPR for Oregonians in Eugene, 89.7 FM KLCC, KLCO Newport 90.5, KLFR Reedsport 89.1, and at 88.1 KMPQ Roseburg, KLFO Florence, KLBR Bend, on the web at klcc.org, on Facebook and Twitter, and we have an app for your smartphone or tablet.
Welcome back to the December 4th City Club program. Science, Policy, and Passion Reflect Challenges Facing Bees. Our guest speakers are Ramesh Sajili, Amy Code, and Jen Hornaday. City Club members, please identify yourselves and keep your questions to about 30 seconds each.
Camilla Pratt, City Club member. When we go out to buy, let's say, tomato plants or pansy plants, how do we know a plant is organically grown? Is there any certification for that? In other words, how do we find a place to buy good plants?
One of the things that I do is that I know that Hayhurst is really good for their vegetables. I know 100% they're organic. They work super hard. When you go to the store and you find a Peoria tag, Peoria now has a Peoria organics tag, and that one is organics. The other one that doesn't say organics, they may have something in it. I'm not sure exactly what they do put in it, but it's not as healthy as something with organics. Besides that, you can pull the tag up, look on the back. There should be a phone number of the place that made it and be able to call them right there. I do that often when I'm especially at like the grocery store or something like that, or Bi-Mart that I don't really know. I'll just take that tag out with my smartphone while I'm doing other shopping. I carry it around in my cart and I make a phone call. I ask the person, the buyer in the store, if they're available to talk to. And sometimes I'll even set that aside and I'll wait 2 or 3 days in their store or put it back on the shelf until I get a phone call back from that company. I have done that this summer alone and I've gotten calls back, and sometimes it takes that long for them to get back to me. And they said, oh, yeah, we used to use that stuff, but we don't anymore. And I'm like, okay, did you dispose of it properly at Lane County Hazardous Waste Society? Great, thanks a lot. Okay, and those kinds of things. But just so you know, and we know, that it can be done, and we've got to start with it. Because if all of a sudden these plants are dying in the storefront, they're going to put them off 50% and down to 75% off. But if no one's buying them, then they're going to truly try to have to change their ways. Thanks.
Linda Jensen, City Club member. Could you give us an update on what is being done locally and nationally to try and ban products that are detrimental to bees, and let us know, as a public, what we can do to help out in those efforts?
Sure. This is Amay Code speaking. There's so many areas to focus on. Let's see, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency is the main agency that regulates pesticides. And so when you're looking at how to protect pollinators from pesticides, there are a number of different comment periods that come up, and you can submit information. So imidacloprid is one of the main neonicotinoids. It was the first one that came out on the market. It's extremely long-lived. There's going to be comment period coming up on it. There's actually a risk assessment regarding specifically bees, and a chemical imidacloprid is about to undergo a risk assessment at the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, and there will be comment periods. So that's one way. At the state level, here in Oregon, we have a pollinator protection plan that the state is going to be working on. We need to have people involved in speaking up for how to create pollinator protection plans that really work for our state and work for the things that we want. And locally, there's a lot of ways. I mean, talking to your city council, working with your community and your neighbors, and obviously making a pollinator garden in your yard, just to start.
Yeah, John DeLow, City Club. I got two quick questions. One is, if you drive around the countryside, you often see these boxes by the side of the road. I'm assuming those are bees inside those things. Is there a certain kind of bee in those, or are they all different? And also, what kind of effect, if any, does climate change have on the bee population?
Yeah, so this is Ramesh Sagili from Oregon State University. So, the boxes most probably that you are looking at on the roadsides could be honeybee hives, and these are only specific honeybees. There is no other bee that is kept in boxes like that at this point. So those are about 50,000 honeybees that you see probably around a crop, if it's around, or maybe they might be having a holding yard where sometimes you keep bees in off-season. So that's called a holding yard. So you might be seeing some of those. And coming back to your second question on climate change, that's a very wide topic, very broad area. And as you know, honeybees have been only in the limelight, or other bees have been in the limelight only for the last 10 years, as I said in my speech as well, that they have been taken for granted. So there's not much research on climate change. So at least I'm seeing there are a few labs that have started working on that area. But at least at this point, I would say there is not much research on climate change.
This is Amay Code with the Xerces Society, and just a very quick addition on climate change. One of the reasons that our native bees are so important is because climate change is obviously shifting when things are blooming, how things can or can't be pollinated, and the diversity of our native bees can help buffer some of those effects by ensuring you've got a bee out at the time when you've got a crop in pollination. So just an addition on that.
Jerry Smith, City Club member since 2003. How can we counter the political power of poison-selling corporations like Monsanto, who even get their employees into government-regulating positions like EPA, Food, and Drug Administration? What political groups do we have on our side?
Well, I think I wouldn't have a job if I knew the answer to that. I wish I did have the answer. The power of industry to push their agenda and the economic drive of the pesticide industry is really hard to counter. But I think doing what we can at the local level and making sure that we provide the science so that our regulators understand the risks is really still such an important and valuable part of it. Sometimes I feel like I'm taking very small steps forward, but they always are steps forward to broaden the information, explain the science, and make sure that that moves the agenda.
Kathy Ging, do you think that U.S. research is biased by funding, as with GM Foods? Studies in Germany and Africa and elsewhere, like this one in Germany from 2007, Bees, Birds, and Mankind, Destroying Nature by Electrosmog, Effects of Mobile Radio and Wireless Communication, indicates that there's a substance in bees' eyes that is adversely affected and hurts their navigation, and also their bodies are just made that they can maximally be affected by the microwaves. So I'm asking you, were you aware of this research, and will America be more cautious in use of wireless technology to save bees, birds, and humanity?
This is Ramesh Sagili. I think probably I can try your question, answering your question. So there is not much research, as you said. I know you gave me a copy as well. Yes, some work was done in Germany with this microwave stuff. But unfortunately, I know this is a brochure that you gave me, but they have not published in a peer-reviewed journal. That's what people look for. So I would hope more people like this who have already done some research, they come forward and publish in a peer-reviewed journal where everyone like you have access to it, and it's more credible. It's like, I can do some research, but if I don't publish it in a peer-reviewed journal, it's not of much use for the audience. So that's what they should do, and I'm aware of some of this that you're talking about. And yeah, unfortunately, we don't have much research that has been done on these lines in the United States. And as you said, Europe has their own priorities as well. I know they're more sensitive to some issues than what we are in the United States. Probably that has to do with how big our agriculture is here or several other things. Like Europe, I think I may have mentioned that they have banned some of the neonicotinoids in Europe, but we are not so much into that at this point. The EPA is more cautious because the agriculture is so dependent on those. So they want to find an alternative before they take action against those things. So I think those are some things that I would mention are probably different when compared to Europe, and that's why our research is a little more different, or the priorities are different here.
This is Jen Horney with Healthy Bees, Healthy Gardens. I do, when I do education in the school districts, I hand out a different flyer that what are some of the things they can possibly do to help the bees. And I've heard a little bit about that there's problems with radio towers and Wi-Fi and things like that. And I don't have, you know, exact knowledge to say, to proof to say that this is. But if I was a beekeeper and what I educate other beekeepers, when they're setting up a hive, they need to be setting the hive up where it's facing east to southeast so they have morning sun and afternoon shade. So when I'm putting plants in the ground, if I know that there's where the hive is and where it's facing and where I'm going to put food versus where that big radio tower is and cell towers and things like that, I can, you know, at least try to put them in an area so that they're not having to sweep on through that a million times a day. And then I can turn my Wi-Fi off on my phone or just turn my cell phone off when I'm working around the bees. So if there is possibly something going on, that at least I can stop that myself. You know, so that's something that y'all can do.
Nancy Off-Rose, City Club. First of all, I would like to thank all of you for using the microphone and standing up when you speak. I appreciate that. It makes it much easier to be heard out there and to see you. No, not right, but you don't need to do it right now. Just when you were speaking. Yeah, I'm sorry. My question has to do with other black and yellow little animals that fly. And I like bees. I grow a lot of things that need pollinization. But they get chewed on by various bugs. And those yellow jackets that you talk about that do eat bees occasionally eat far more other bugs. And I like them, and I don't want people out killing yellow jackets or bees. And what do you... I wish that somebody would... I know yellow jackets don't provide a lot of honey for us, okay? But how can you people help people better understand yellow jackets aren't bad at all, unless they sting you? Thank you.
I'll just talk about the benefits of yellow jackets. I know yellow jackets are not harmful if unless they're a menace for you, if they're in your backyard or something, and if you have an allergy and those kind of aspects, I think, you have to be careful as long as they are not a nuisance pest for you. But otherwise, yellow jackets have a role to play in the ecosystem as well. They eat up a lot of bad caterpillars. I don't know if you, many of you probably are not aware. They can eat up all those bad caterpillars that eat on leaves and other things, on crops, or it could be any plant. So they are very beneficial in one term. But then when they become a havoc, like maybe in your backyard when they're a nuisance, then probably you have to do something about trapping them. Or if your bees are being exposed to these yellow jackets and your bee populations are declining, probably you can take some actions like trapping queens and those things what Jen was alluding to.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Hi, Cole Gill, City Club member since 2006. Thanks for all the information today. I'm actually asking a question on behalf of some student beekeepers and farm designers at Kalapuya High School. I'm working on the Bethel Farm. And so they had a question about the scale of pesticide use when you compare it to different areas. So, for example, is there more pesticide use in managing forests, large-scale agriculture, backyards, or city, county, state parks? And just to add to that, so, you know, for example, if more is used in parks, then that might be the first place to tackle. And if they do use it in city parks, is there a system for notifying communities so that if a school wanted to take on a project to go and do the weeding like you talked about, that they would know that that's coming and they could sign up to support?
This is Jen Hornaday with Healthy Bees, Healthy Gardens. So, yes, I'm in touch with the City of Eugene. I have been caring for the park next to my house. We call it Cadogan Park or Maynard Park. It's out River Road behind the drive-through Dairy Mart, and I've been kind of taking care of that for about 8 years, and I did plant some native trees in there, and that's the park party I was talking about on December 19th. Lorna Baldwin is the person that is the taking care of the parks out in there. She's responsible for the volunteer coordinator, so I communicate with her about having a park party once or twice a year, and then she makes sure that it gets put in the weekly and lets us borrow tools and snacks and gloves and things like that. And so that's a good way of being able to do it. You can contact the city and say that you're willing to be able to, you know, volunteer and have a group of people. That's awesome. You can come to my park. There's other of my friends have been digging up poison oak this summer and blackberries and whatnot. We're really doing a big chunk right along the River Road in particular right now and really working with the city to say, please don't spray. Please let us know when your spray schedule is, when you come out and look to see what you don't want, and then communicate with us and give us not 2 days notice, but please give us 6 months notice so that we can coordinate with the right weather and get enough people to be able to come to a park party. And what I'm working to do is to try to get a nice laminated pretty picture of the knapweed and what it looks like in all stages of its beauty so that people who are just walking through the park can, in their own time, bring a shovel, come on down and look for it and dig it up. And it's like finding a needle in a haystack sometimes. It's a pretty little purple flower. And so that is something that you all can do is say, hey, I want to volunteer. How I can do that? Call the City Parks Department. They'll put you in touch with the right people to be able to find out what time of day is best for you, what day of the week, and blah, 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 and, you know, and help out. So, and we're hoping to get more signs out there to be able to show people what's not wanted and to help out. So thanks.
Robin Fletcher, City Club member since 2004. And I was wondering what kinds of the winter, you were talking about the winter feedings that they do. What is out there for bees this time of year, and what should an urban gardener do to make sure that there's fodder for them?
Water, did you say at the end?
Fodder.
Oh, fodder. Okay.
Food.
Forage. So food, yeah. So I'm Jen Hornaday with Healthy Bees, Healthy Gardens, and right now we just had up to 15, or down as low as 15 degree weather. I still have borage, I still have phacelia. That winter camellia is starting to do its thing. I have flowering broccoli and flowering kale. So some of the things that have lasted throughout that cold weather. Putting in different cover crops, the crimson clover, I have to check to see if that's hardy enough to withstand right now. But different things that you're looking at to be able to put in, those different seedlings you can buy in, like, by the tablespoon, even at Down to Earth, also to be able to put in some of these crops. And the way my gardens go, it says pollinator garden, vegetable garden, pollinator garden. So I kind of sandwich it in. And so if you can think about putting in, like, a breadcrumb trail of pollinator plants, you know, in sequential order to be able to bring them to your favorite apple tree or whatnot, then that's really helpful too. And, you know, that's where the shallow water dishes go in all these places. They remember where that water dish is, just like the hummingbird remembers where it is. And please remember to take care of those hummingbirds too. When it's cold out, have a second feeder that you've got inside, so when it freezes and you wake up early, bring the frozen one in and put the other one out, because they really do rely on us. Not all of them go away for the winter just because we take our feeders in. So thanks.
Do you guys want to add anything to that? Or
no, it's good.
I have one comment and one question. One comment relates to the effects of climate change. And one thing that I've noticed in my yard over the past year is that my Pink Dawn Viburnum blooms one branch at a time every month or two, which is crazy. You know, the leaves got frozen in the last round of cold weather, and the blossoms will probably fall off. But it's been, instead of blooming all at once, it's sequencing, which is the starkest evidence I've had of change in my own yard. And I wondered if you had any comments about that, or have noticed other crops that are doing the same thing. And the other question is rather more complicated, I think, and has to do with the low-dose calculations of the effects of low-dose. I was involved in the Hanford Health Effects Study Committee, and the whole argument there was, can you prove that low dose over time has any effect on health and cancer rates specifically for exposed workers and downwinders and residents of the area? So I was thinking about that in terms of the trouble proving that the whatever that word is, how they affect and what you can prove about that, and the fact that there are like 14 regulatory agencies, each with their own turf and tactics, trying to figure out that. So just talk to us a little bit about the strategies that can be used to try and cut through some of that wall of denial.
This is Amay with the Xerces Society. It's true, we definitely are people who look for a smoking gun, and we want a linear process to move through. And the reality is that's not how most of these things work. And so if you want a smoking gun, you're not necessarily going to get the answers that you want. The reality with our pollinators, we are seeing really subtle effects that are not easily observed from these low-dose exposures. And there's a lot of arguments right now asking, well, what are the exposures in the field? Are those exposures in the field equal to what you're doing in the lab? And are we going to see these effects in the field? Many of the studies are trying to respond to those kind of questions. It's not easy, but for example, there's a lot of studies that are done in the field now where they don't go out, where they'll go out and they'll plant a field with coated seed, for example, and then they observe, what do they see in that field compared to a control field where there wasn't coated seed planted? And seeing those differences and doing it multiple times and replicating it and noticing there might be really subtle differences, but wait, what's the abundance of the bees that are in that area? What's the diversity of bees in that area? Are they nesting? Are they acting differently? And those are not the kind of obvious sort of tests that are done by our regulatory system to put a test pesticide on the market. And that's a problem, because those sort of subtle effects that we aren't looking at in our regulatory system are actually being observed when we do those studies. So I think there's a real importance to have us take a more cautionary approach to our regulation and not put things on the market until we understand more. And oftentimes to understand more, we do need to be doing these field tests that are looking for the subtle effects.
This is Ramesh Sagida. I have a couple of points for her as well. So your first question was about climate change, how it's affecting blooming times, and like you explained a good example how you are seeing some kind of flowering that's not happening in a continuous manner. There are a few studies that have shown the plant physiology is changing because of the temperatures and all these different changes we see as a result of climate change. And in some cases, they have shown at least some plants are blooming 2 weeks ahead of time. So that's a concern because some bees, like the native bees that these folks have been talking about, sometimes they emerge sooner than later, or maybe there is a certain time. Maybe March is the time when most of your bumblebees or other native bees that are overwintering in the soil come out. And if your plant has already bloomed 2 weeks before they even come out, then there is a mismatch in their forage that is available. So those are things that I think are being addressed slowly. As I said, climate change is a totally new issue now, and so there are people getting into that type of research. And coming back to your second question on how this low dose, I think MI mentioned most of the points, but the challenge with this is we are working with not only just native bees, honeybees, and it's a very complex biology, and they forage for 3 mile radius, like it's 27 square mile radius you can think of, so there is not much control. So that's the reason why, as a researcher, it's hard for us to prove the effects, because if it was something in a cage I was doing, probably it's easier, right? Or if they could listen to us, don't go more than a mile here, I'm going to test you before in this radius. So that's the challenge we have as bee researchers, to prove any of those low-dose things. But I'm glad there is more research going on now, and I think with all the evidence that we will pile up in the next 5 years, I'm hoping EPA and others will act as well.
Sandy Erickson, City Club member. A while back, we had two programs on food, and that got me more concerned about the future food supply. And the thing that my question is about is, it seems that other industries have extensive lobbying networks. They have political infrastructure, basically, that's been long established and often is not transparent. So I'm wondering whether people in various areas of agriculture and food supply actually coalesce, and whether there is that kind of political power or clout that exists now or can in the future. What needs to happen on a legislative basis in order to make it be more important, which it is actually physically more important than many other industries, and not so that each area of the food supply is operating like a silo, each doing well in their silo, but not together enough to form a political force.
This is Amay with the Xerces Society. I'll try to address that. I think a lot of our growers have come together and are becoming more politically savvy and recognizing that they need to have a voice. There's funding through USDA, through the Natural Resource Conservation Service, and farmers are getting together in order to make sure that the kind of funding that's available to create sustainable agriculture does exist. There's more and more organizations that are coming together and conferences on where do we overlay, our agricultural system with the political system? And I think that's really where, so it is happening, yes.
John Belcher, City Club member, thank you all for being here. Nancy told us about the positive benefits of yellow jackets, but I still have a question, and that is, if I have yellow jackets in my yard and I want to get rid of them, either because they're right next to my patio or because I'm concerned about bees, what's the most effective non-pesticide way to deal with them?
Jen Hornaday, Healthy Bees, Healthy Gardens. We use a shop vac. We just, get the extension cord out there, wear protective bee clothing. You can actually wear a rain jacket and you can put over a a bug nest over your face, or you know, glasses and a bandana if you don't own, you know, protective clothing and gloves. And you just find the hole right where they're going in. Those yellow jackets are coming in and out right in a very specific area. So just put the nozzle of that shot back right there. Start thunking up. You'll hear thunk, 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 thunk. Takes about 15 minutes. Have your shovel ready. Remove that. Take that shovel. Dig on in. Continue to thunk, 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 and then you will be able to remove that nest. You may have a few that have coming back home that may not be so happy with you, so be ready for that. But in general, it takes about 10, 15 minutes, and it's done. And then just shovel up, dig, expose their, you know, their home to the elements, and then they will not be able to survive. So that's my best way.
So a couple of follow-ups, if I may.
Please.
First of all, is it better to do it early or late at night so they're more calm?
Most of them will be home. We usually do it in the later afternoon, you know, happy hour time.
And the second question is it true that a yellow jacket nest only lasts for a year and then the queen dies and moves on, or is it a perennial issue?
Ramesh, you can add more if you want. What I know is that the queens go out in the early spring and they collect enough, you know, food, nectar, pollen for themselves to be able to start growing their babies. And then once the babies are born, they're old enough to go out. They actually have enough what's called basically colostrum, you know, from their mother for a while, so they're not real stinkers and protein, you know, naggers until the middle of hot summer when we have lots of barbecues. And so that's why they're not really bad at first, or it's troublesome. But then once the other ones are out, then they do their thing. Once the babies do die off, the queen does need to come back out again in the fall. You may see them around now. They'll be looking for little places like burlap to, or even egg cartons or something like that in wood piles to be able to get. It's a good time to find them this time of year now if you can find those queens, if you do want to get rid of them, or do little special hidey places for them that you check.
So, thank you.
Do you want to add something, Ramesh?
Ramesh Sagili. Yeah, I think what Jen said is absolutely right. So the new queens, they seek new nesting locations every time once they are back in spring. So, yeah, there is no guarantee that they'll pick the same location again. So, but it could happen as well. Same with honeybees. It's just a matter of chance that sometimes they pick the same locations if it's attractive. But, yeah, there is no guarantee that they'll come back to the same location. The new queens are looking for new nest locations as well.
Clay Stevens, City Club member since 2013. My question is there any indication of or research lately about if the bees right now are getting more resistant to pesticides through natural selection from the ones that have just died off easily from this exposure? Is there perhaps some hope that the ones that are surviving becoming more resistant? And secondly, is there any research about possibly modifying the genes of bees to perhaps be more resistant, releasing them out, or even less tasty for yellow jackets or something like that? I know there's some progress on this for mosquitoes that I've recently read, so I just wonder if there's any thoughts or research on this for bees. Thanks.
Yeah, Ramesh Sagili from OSU. Good question. I wish there was a better answer, but natural selection is a long time process. It takes 100 years, 1,000 years, we don't know. And especially with honeybees, I can speak more for honeybees because I work with honeybees. And like even the ectoparasite, the mite I talked about, we have been struggling to get resistance for that mite. So pesticides are a totally different issue. And there are mutations that happen in bees and several other organisms as well, as you know. So natural selection is a long process, but I don't know if, I'm not aware of any research that is really looking for having some resistance against chemicals. So there could be some natural resistance if you use the same, but then the chemicals are coming up like in a very speedy manner, right? You get a new chemical every year. So what are you looking for? Are you looking for one mode of action? Because that chemical will be gone in next year. So the resistance for each of these chemicals is a different phenomena, right? It's not, so your bee can have a resistance for maybe a synthetic pyrethroid, but it may not be able to have for neonicotinoid or something like that. So it's pretty tricky, and especially bee breeding is a very complex phenomena as well, and or an endeavor. So yeah, so I don't think anyone is really trying at this point to get any resistance. And I think your second question was about similar lines, right? Having modifying genes, yeah. I am not aware of any research that is being done to modify genes in bees to see if they can take more pesticides on.
All right. Thank you, Ramesh Sajili, Amy Code, and Jen Hornaday for bringing clarity and vision to the City Club program. Science, policy, and passion reflect challenges facing bees. And thanks again to our sponsors, Oregon Country Fair, Eugene Legal, and PacInfo. We meet again on December 11th at the Downtown Athletic Club for annual gifts to the city with various guests and gifters. Lunches for this program can be ordered on City Club's website or by contacting the office. Thank you.